A suspect is in custody after the shooting death of a Sacramento City police officer. On Insight, more about what happened yesterday and into the night last night in what started as a domestic disturbance call. California's attorney general says a more diverse staff would better represent the state. State government reporter Scott Rodd expands on the AG's comments in this week's Capitol Chat. The Summer of Hate in 1999. We'll reflect on that history with Willie Recht of the Sacramento Region Jewish Federation. Three synagogues in the area were firebombed. Two men in Redding were murdered in their home. Events are planned this weekend at the California Museum to bring the community together. Later in the hour, entertainment in Davis. A production of the musical Rent continues, and lots of great music with the 9th Annual Davis Music Fest. I'm Beth Ruriak. That's today on Insight. First, the news. Live from Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Beth Ruriak. Sacramento police officer Tara O'Sullivan died last night in an incident that began as a domestic disturbance call. She had just graduated from the police academy in December. She was 26 years old. In 2017, she was part of the first class to graduate from the new Law Enforcement Candidate Scholars Program at Sacramento State. She then graduated from Sac State in 2018 with a BA in Child Development. Sac State President Robert Nelson today wrote, "Our hearts go out to Tara's family, friends, classmates, and fellow officers. This exceptional young officer will be remembered by the Hornet family for her intelligence, her commitment to public service, and her bravery." Cap Radio reporter Sammy Kayola followed the events through the night last night. She's with me in the studio. Thanks for being here today, Sammy. And I guess the latest news is that there is a suspect in custody.
That's correct. So he was safely detained, so he's not in the neighborhood anymore. We don't really know a lot about this person other than he was male and that it was an hours-long ordeal trying to make that area safe because this person was armed, they think, with a rifle and was sporadically shooting throughout the day and the evening.
At first, the storylines were a little bit confusing because a lot of this happened last evening, but the first call came before noon. And then how did it unfold?
Yeah, so it started at about 11:43 a.m., to be very precise, with a call to a different place that was actually in the Arden Arcade area. And it was a disturbance between a male and a female. And so it started with that. But then we know sometime later in the afternoon, the female needed to get some belongings from a property that was in North Sacramento. And so officers responded to be on standby while she collected those items, I guess because they were, you know, worried it might be an unsafe situation. And so we know that Tara O'Sullivan was part of at least that second group of officers that joined around 5:41 p.m.
There was a shooting and then a space of time before she was able to be transported. So we're going to hear more about that in a moment, but just a little of the chronology there.
Yeah, so we know that the shots began ringing out a little after 6 p.m., and we knew that the officer, O'Sullivan, was struck by gunfire. But then, you know, they weren't able to send an armored vehicle in for her until about 40 minutes after that.
I want to take this through some of the sound that you were able to gather, and there was a middle-of-the-night press conference. But let's start with the fact that once Officer O'Sullivan had been transported to the med center, it was still what they consider, what, an active shooter situation?
Yeah. So she had been transported, and people were starting to gather at the UC Davis Medical Center. So I was there, but there were still many officers on the scene. I also went to the scene, and there were ambulances, a lot of streets blocked off, caution tape. I talked to neighbors who were just sort of unsettled and confused. People were being evacuated to an elementary school for safety. So you had sort of that active scene there, and then this other scene at the med center. And then when the press conference happened, which was around 12:30, a little after midnight, Officer Vance Chandler was very clear that this was still happening.
We do believe that this subject does have a rifle, and he has shot this rifle multiple times, obviously shot and killed one of our officers. Not too long ago, he was still firing this weapon, so we do want help in relaying the message that the area is still dangerous at this time, and we do not want people in the area because we do not want anybody else being harmed.
Again, that was from the middle of the night last night. The suspect is in custody now, so there is no longer danger or warning to people in the neighborhood. But what you heard there was the acknowledgement that by that time, Officer O'Sullivan had been pronounced dead.
Right, and that was the first official announcement that she had died. And it was a very profound moment. Mayor Steinberg was there, Councilmember Angelique Ashby was there, and they really recognized her for her bravery and talked a lot about the service that she'd done. And, you know, at this point, I'd already been at the hospital and I was getting the sense there was a hearse. You know, there were people gathered looking like they were ready to do a procession. And that is what they ended up doing a little bit later in the night.
Here's a little bit of what Dave Paletta told you at this point in time last night.
We're devastated tonight. There are no words to convey the depth of sadness we feel or how heartbroken we are for our family of our young, brave officer. The men and women of our department will continue to do our jobs to protect the community, and we will draw from the strength and courage of Tara. Our hearts are with Tara's family, whose pain can hardly be imagined. Our department has been called on before to shoulder the immense grief of losing an officer, and we have done so in honor. I'm confident we will do so again, and in doing so, we will honor Tara and the courage that she showed yesterday.
So that was Dave Paletta. He was the deputy chief of the Sacramento Police Department. He was acting as a spokesperson last night. And he addressed the questions about why it took so long to get to Tara after she had been shot.
Which was somewhere in the realm of just under an hour.
It was about 40 minutes.
Okay.
45 minutes. And it sounds like it was a pretty complex situation in there. And here's how he describes it.
You know, the first thing you think of is what safety equipment can we put between our officers and the person firing or the area that's getting fired upon. And in this case, we try to use an armored vehicle, but because of the location that where she was at, made it very difficult to get the armored vehicle there. But we don't do any good if we send personnel up just to have more people hurt or injured. And so some of these things, unfortunately, they take time and you strategically have to think through them. And of course, you always have the terrain that sometimes you have to navigate too.
So at this press conference, you said that the mayor spoke, and I think from the mayor's perspective, looking at the community, it was the experience of the loss of this officer, the loss of Natalie Corona not so long ago, and before that, there had been quite a gap of time.
Yeah, he actually did tie together those two officer deaths, Natalie Corona, as you mentioned, and gave us a little history on that.
It has been 20 years since our department has lost one of its own in the line of duty. But our last two academy classes have each lost an officer in the line of duty. Both Natalie Corona and Tara O'Sullivan had bright futures ahead of them. They were committed to our communities, committed to protect and serve selflessly. They had big dreams and even bigger hearts.
Again, that was Mayor Steinberg from the middle of the night. Sacramento City Police Officer Tara O'Sullivan died in the line of duty. And there will be unfolding news about this. One thing we didn't mention is much detail about the suspect at this point.
Yeah, that's because we don't have much at this point. But do stay tuned throughout the day. It's something we're hoping to gather more information on. We don't know much about him, but he is in custody. So that will be unfolding. And we're also looking to learn a little bit more about Tara O'Sullivan and the programs that she was in and sort of what this says about you know, the police force and diversity and community relations, because that seemed to come up a lot last night.
There was a remarkable spontaneous procession, I understand, from the med center once her body was being moved. And I think it's in situations like this where nobody really even needs to be called. It's just there. It's a brotherhood and sisterhood, sort of a humanity coming together.
Yeah, by the time I showed up, there were dozens of people, you know, people in uniform, people not in uniform, consoling each other, you know, and just sort of waiting to pay tribute that way. Yeah.
All right, Sammy, thanks for joining us this morning. Thanks for your coverage. And again, we'll continue to be on the story throughout the day. You can follow it online and on air at capradio.org.
Thanks, Beth.
Now to this week's Capitol Chat, and we're going to shift gears and talk about California's Attorney General. He's been speaking about the need for more diversity. State government reporter Scott Rodd is with me in the studio for that story. Hi, Scott.
Hi, Beth.
So what's the issue in the California Department of Justice? And maybe the better question is, what are the numbers in this story?
So the issue is that California is a very diverse state. However, the attorneys in the Attorney General's office don't reflect that diversity. So to give you some numbers, California's Hispanic population makes up about 40% of the people in the state. However, in the Attorney General's office, only 7% of the attorneys are Hispanic or Latino. White Californians are 40%, or I should actually say 37% of the population. However, in the Attorney General's office, they make up about 70% of the attorneys. African Americans make up about 6% of the state's population. They're about 3% of the attorneys in the Attorney General's office. So you can see a disparity there between the diversity in the state and the diversity or the lack of diversity, or not as much diversity, in the attorneys that represent the people of the state.
Can you take this a little further and talk about the issues that arise or could potentially arise with a staff that doesn't reflect the picture of the true state population?
Sure. So diversity is important in any workplace, right? Studies have shown that more creativity and more better workflow happens when there's diversity. There's a different dimension to it, though, in the Attorney General's office, because they have to represent the interests of the people of California in the court system.
Right.
So that means bringing cases, but that also means defending the state in certain cases and identifying which cases to jump into, in recognizing that certain cases will have an impact and sometimes a disproportionate impact on certain communities. So the concern is that if the attorneys don't reflect the people of the state, they're not going to have the background experience and the lived experience to say, okay, this legal issue, this specific case will have a big impact on this group of people, or they may not be able to understand how to approach a certain case that will have an impact on those communities. And I spoke with Bianca Sierra Wolf. She's with a group called Change Lawyers, which is a group that aims to break down barriers in the legal profession. And she summed it up pretty succinctly.
How can we say that our justice system works for all Californians if it's not reflective of that state?
So again, underscoring that issue of, if there isn't diversity in the Attorney General's office, how can they fully represent the diversity of the state?
To be fair, this is a problem at the county level, too, in a number of district attorneys' offices. But do you have any sense of how the county issue with diversity compares to what the state's dealing with in the numbers you just described?
You know, that's a great question, and that's something that I hope to pursue in follow-up reporting. This was something that came onto my radar somewhat by happenstance. I was at a state personnel board hearing for a totally unrelated story, and the HR representative from the Attorney General's office was testifying about this issue, and it just struck me as a really interesting topic. So I pursued the state-level side, and I think it would definitely be worth looking at, okay, what's happening at the county level as well.
So I'm assuming that the DOJ is tracking these numbers. And when you engage the Attorney General in a conversation about this, was there any surprise or was there complete awareness that the situation existed?
You know, there was a good amount of awareness. The Attorney General Javier Becerra didn't shy away from acknowledging this issue, and it's actually something that his office has made a priority to change. And this is what he had to say about it.
We have to admit, there aren't as many people of color who are attorneys in California as you might think, given the general population distribution. That doesn't give you an excuse not to hire people who are from that background if you can, but it may make it tougher to fill a pool of qualified candidates from those particular communities.
So there you hear him saying, you know, this is an issue. This can be even a challenge to get a diverse pool to choose attorneys from to fill the office. But that's no excuse. There should be proactive efforts made to for recruitment, but also to engage
into law schools.
Exactly. Going to law schools.
Into the education leading up to the possibility.
Exactly. And he even said in high school and colleges, making it clear to students from diverse backgrounds that you can be an attorney. You can go into this profession, and paving that road for them.
So this has been a two-part story for you. It's not up online yet, but it will be later today?
Yes, later today. So the second part is airing today, and listeners can find it online this afternoon.
Okay, and as you said, it's a to be continued, because answering one question raises two or three or more.
Yes, as with most stories, once you start to ask questions, those only start to open more doors.
I'm talking to Cap Radio state government reporter Scott Rodd. Governor Gavin Newsom issued an apology this week. It's worth noting in this week's Capital Chat. Was there anything specific that prompted the timing of this?
So I haven't been able to identify something specific that prompted Governor Gavin Newsom's apology to the Native American community in California, aside from the fact that this appears to be long overdue. This the governor's office has said, and from what I could see, this is the case, the first time that the state of California has apologized for some of the atrocities that have taken place against Native Americans in California throughout the last 150 plus years. So as far as a specific incident goes or some sort of anniversary, that there doesn't appear to be anything, but Governor Gavin Newsom made it clear that he felt that this was long overdue.
He met with tribal leaders on Tuesday, and here's a bit of what he said.
We apologize on behalf of the citizens of California, to all California Native Americans, for the many instances of violence, maltreatment, neglect, murder inflicted on the tribes.
Beyond his words, what else is involved in this apology, and what does it mean in a bigger sense?
So the plan is to set up what's being called a Truth and Healing Council. The idea is to allow the Native American community to work with the state to identify inconsistencies in the historical record and correct the historical record to make sure that those atrocities are not forgotten, to make sure that these instances of violence, as the governor said, are not lost in the history books. As far as hard policy goes, as far as allocation of resources goes, there isn't anything yet in the as far as reflected in the executive order from Governor Newsom. And this was something that was acknowledged by some of the tribal leaders. From what I could see, everyone at this gathering from these tribes appreciated Governor Gavin Newsom's apology. However, at least one tribal leader said, you know, this apology is very important, but actions speak louder than words. And we would like to see follow-up to this. What sort of resources may be allocated? What sort of follow-up and perhaps money and resources dedicated to this issue?
All right. You've had a busy week. There's even more reporting on other topics on our website. So I'll refer everybody for more state government news to capradio.org. Thank you again for joining us on a busy day.
Thank you.
That is Cap Radio state government reporter Scott Rodd. And again, capradio.org for continuing coverage today and more news. And you are listening to Insight on your NPR station, Cap Radio.
We'll be right back.
Welcome back to Insight Live on CAP Radio. I'm Beth Ruriak. The summer of 1999 has often been called the summer of hate. A wave of hate crimes happened across the country, and in the Sacramento area, three synagogues were firebombed, two gay men were murdered in their homes in Redding, and the murders were ultimately linked to the arson, and two white supremacists, two brothers, held responsible. One brother committed suicide. The other, James Tyler Williams, is at Mule Creek State Prison. We understand he will be up for parole in 2025. The crimes prompted the creation of the Unity Center, a permanent exhibit at the California Museum that celebrates the state's diverse people, its customs and cultures, and its history of activism. And this weekend, the museum is open and free to the public, and there are what's being called Stand Up for Unity in Your Community events. We'll post a link on our website with more information. But to reflect on this history and the way this area has reacted, I have in the studio with me William Recht. He is executive director of the Jewish Federation of the Sacramento Region. Willie, welcome to Insight. Glad to have you here.
Thank you, Beth. Thank you for having me.
I think to frame this time, let me ask you where you were and how old you were when this happened in 1999.
So I was 17 years old. I was a junior in high school in Denver. And remembering back just 2 months almost to the date on April 20th, 1999, the Columbine Massacre happened. Hmm.
Do you remember hearing about this in Sacramento?
I did not. There was so much news in Colorado that I didn't hear about this really until we moved here 4 years ago and I took this job, and I heard about it more than I could have ever imagined. And so leading up to this day on Tuesday, we'd been thinking about this. I'd been thinking about this for years. How would we acknowledge this? How would we remember this?
Tuesday was the specific 20th
Correct.
Anniversary. Your perspective intrigues me as somebody from the outside coming in, and what was described to you initially as the pain and shock, and then that movement toward community unity. What's your take on it? How do you see what happened then?
So I've been to all three synagogues in the past few weeks, and I've been in this community for 4 years, and this is a strong, resilient community. There's a reason that we called the program that took place on Tuesday night the community-wide program, Remembrance and Resilience. Unfortunately, we had been at B'nai Israel three times since November in a community setting like this to gather and to mourn and to remember, starting with Pittsburgh with 1,500 people that showed up in Poway just a few months ago, and now we were here again Tuesday night to remember what happened 20 years ago.
After Poway, Seth Brisk was in our studio, and there was some conversation about anti-Semitism in the country. And we've recued some of what he said because I think it's important to not only this conversation, but the ongoing
sure.
conversation. So let's listen.
It's not so much that there's a great change in the number of people who hold anti-Semitic beliefs. Those numbers have been fairly consistent over the last few decades. About 10% of the American population hold anti-Semitic beliefs, which, it means that it's relegated largely to the fringe. What we've been seeing, though, in the last few years is an emboldening of those people who hold those beliefs to act out on them.
That was Seth Brisk, the regional director of the Anti-Defamation League, and he had joined us on May 1st by phone from San Francisco. What about the then and now?
So Seth was at the community. He came from San Francisco on Tuesday night and spoke to the community as well. I mean, it's sadly not shocking. This is not new. The Jewish community and now other communities have been victims of hate for decades. And so sadly, we know what to do. It doesn't make it any easier, but we do know what to do. We've had to hire private security at the Federation building multiple times in the past few months. And it's just a new normal. But it hasn't stopped anybody from doing what we have to do, for showing up for each other, for loving each other, and for coming together for each other when we need to.
If some of the numbers, as Seth says, in terms of attitude, have stayed the same, what can provoke any change, bigger change, to that in this country?
I really think it all comes from fear deep down. I think if more people knew each other, I mean, we've gone to the Salaam Center in recent months and stood with our Muslim brothers and sisters. It's not knowing each other. I really do believe that. And I live in this little, Jewish bubble. Of course, I expand out. But the more we get to know each other, the more we understand each other, how can we hate each other?
Is some of that at a grassroots level growing in a way that maybe just hasn't reached a tipping point yet? And I know to some people
the
that's
going to... The hate or the getting to know each other?
No, the getting to know each other, because that's maybe a Pollyanna attitude. I'll give you that. But there are so many facets of our society where we are talking about what you just said, coming together, knowing each other, reaching out, understanding.
Unfortunately, unfortunately, these attacks that have taken place, especially within the Jewish community, have really helped us get to know our brothers and sisters, too. I received letters from Bishop Soto after the Pittsburgh massacre. We have letters from the Council General and calls. We got random postcards from people just saying they stood with us. And when we connect with each other and get to know each other again, it is much harder. And I do think it's happening, sadly, because of tragic events that have taken place. But it has helped propel conversations. It has helped people reach out and get to know each other in ways that they may not have done before.
What do you see your job as being then today in the climate that we're talking about?
I mean, I see my job as two pieces. One is really building community, both in the Jewish community and outside of the Jewish community. And within the Jewish community, providing people of all walks of Jewish life a place, an opportunity to come together and be Jewish together.
Just as a point of history, I will say that it was Congregation B'nai Israel, Congregation Beth Shalom, and the Knesset Israel Torah Center that were firebombed.
Correct.
20 years ago. Nobody was hurt in those fires, but there was quite extensive damage, I think upwards of $3 million.
Right. So as I sat with Rabbi Alfie in her office leading up to the service on Tuesday night, we were talking about what we were going to do, how we were going to do this, what we were going to say, and she took three books from her bookshelf and held them, and they still smelled like smoke. She kept them there on purpose. When I was at Beth Shalom the Friday night before, they had framed remnants of the Israeli flag that was burned almost to shreds. And so it lives on. I mean, and it should live on, and it should be remembered. But the love and the beauty that is in those congregations today, it is truly remarkable.
So what should be symbolized by that? And I think that's what the museum and these events have been trying to do, too, is remind people of the coming together that happened after the crimes.
Right. So I was not here for that, but 5,000 people came together. I've read about it. I've seen pictures. I will never be able to truly understand what that night was like because I wasn't there. But it was amazing what's been done. And there's an incredible interfaith community here in Sacramento. And from what I've heard about that, there were faith leaders from every denomination, from every walk of Sacramento, just as there was in the Pittsburgh memorial that we had in B'nai Israel following that massacre. I mean, we had rows and rows of clergy that came out to support. And that's really an amazing thing.
You're listening to William Recht. He is Executive Director of the Jewish Federation of the Sacramento Region. I do want to talk about what's happening at the museum. You're part of a panel.
I am.
The events are called Stand Up for Unity in Our Community. There are events Saturday and events on Sunday, and it's not only in recognition of what happened 20 years ago, but to put a spotlight on activism and the spirit of bringing the community together. There's a film festival. There are all kinds of family-forward activities.
Yeah, we've worked with the Unity Center for months now, sort of, again, trying to figure out how we would recognize, how we would commemorate, how we would acknowledge what's taken place and what's come from that. And the Unity Center is a wonderful example of what has come from that destruction. And so they put together a wonderful program. I'm honored to be part of it. And, yeah.
Can I take you back to being a teenager at the time that this happened, then, as you said, Columbine happened? How did that influence what you wanted to do as an adult or what you thought the possibilities in life were? Do you remember your mindset as a, what, junior in high school?
I do. I was scared and shocked. I was at a different part of town, but they had locked all the schools. And without getting political, and we don't have to do that, we've almost become desensitized to it. It's happened so many times over the past 20 years, so many times. And if we were all scared and if that limited what we were going to do, nobody could do anything. What would we do? Sit home? We can't do that. And so there is a risk, I guess, but there's always a risk. And so I made it a point to show up.
Did you know anybody connected to Columbine?
I did. And it's hard to think it was 20 years ago. Yeah.
In some ways, there's probably not much difference between the experience of feeling pain in Columbine and the experience of feeling pain 20 years ago in Sacramento. Right. Or.
And I tried, because I felt ill-equipped to represent the community at the beginning, leading up to this memorial, you know, this remembrance of 20 years. And I channeled some of that fear that I felt 20 years ago in my own experience, because I wanted the community to have a meaningful opportunity again to come together and to remember together and feel together.
Where do you think Sacramento, and I say that in the broader region sense, including the pain that happened in Redding for that connection to these crimes, where do you think people are on this today?
I don't know. I can't speak for everybody. I think Tuesday night was a beautiful example. It wasn't just about the three synagogues. We had the brother of Gary Mattson join us. We had the gay men's chorus singing songs. And so this was really about everybody. And if people can continue to come together as they have, hopefully not just for the aftermath of awful events, I think we'll be in good shape.
Some people would probably call you brave for being willing to jump into how big this history was and being such a recent newcomer. I think you've had a lot of mentors, haven't you?
I've had some wonderful mentors. Mm-hmm. I feel very fortunate.
Do we go from here in certain directions of healing that are still unfolding? What's evolving for the community?
I think we just have to keep going forward and doing what we do. And to the extent that we can, loving each other and finding opportunities to come together, because without that, I really don't see how we could move forward and how we would have moved from 20 years ago to where we are today. It's not perfect at all, and it's very scary at times, but we have to keep moving forward.
The panel on Sunday will be led by Feature Well Stories' Karen Breslau, and the panelists include you, as well as Clea Mattson,
yes,
the daughter of Gary Mattson, and the Salaam Islamic Center's imam as well. The community is invited to attend, to participate, to engage. The film Unsettled, Seeking Refuge in America, is on Saturday, directed by Tom Shepard. We'll post a link for a lot of details about these events that are happening. And is there anything else that should be said, Willie, that I haven't asked you about? I feel the same way you do, and I appreciate your honesty in saying, how can we know? How can we speak for anyone or everyone in this? Because I think so many experiences were individual. As you said, Rabbi Mona Alfie, keeping those three books to constantly remember her experience that morning.
I think stories help. I think hearing the stories. Sadly, there was another story that was heard this morning, and the life that was lost this morning, we're still sitting here talking about what's important to remember. Stories matter. You know, I think it's important that we continue to connect and learn each other's stories, and not to sound Pollyanna along with you, but I think that's true.
Maybe we need a little bit more of that. Thank you so much.
Beth, thank you.
Thank you for remembering, and thank you for being with us today.
Thank you.
That is William Recht. He is Executive Director of the Jewish Federation of the Sacramento Region. Remembrances and continued condolences to everyone who experienced the impact of the hate crimes on that day in June of 1999. There's more at capradio.org/insight. You're listening to Insight on Cap Radio. This is Insight, live on Cap Radio. I'm Beth Ruriak. Davis has some entertainment options for the weekend that you might want to consider. Davis Musical Theater Company is staging Rent with 15 cast members ranging in age from 19 to 37. This is a Tony Award-winning musical. It also won the Pulitzer Prize for Drama. It is loosely based on Puccini's La Bohème. And because of Rent's strong language, the adult themes, and the drug references, audience members are required to be at least 13 years old. But the production is getting great reviews. It continues through July 7th. Shows are Friday, Saturdays, and Sundays. We'll post a link to DMTC's website for ticket information. Also this weekend, the 9th Annual Davis Music Fest happens with 40 local, regional, and touring artists from across the region. There are six different venues. Over 3 days, Kyle Monholen is the executive director of the Davis Live Music Collective. He's previewing the festival for this week's Sound Advice. Hi, Kyle.
Hi, thanks for having me.
It's good to look ahead to a weekend. I think everybody's ready for a little breather, and the weather's going to cooperate, too.
Not much we can do about it, but we're grateful for what we get.
Okay, so let's talk about the festival. The philosophy in booking the music that you book for it.
Yeah, it always starts with the music, and we're really lucky to be in a community with really talented musicians who not only are just top of what they're doing, but they more than not get what we're trying to do, which is raise money and awareness for arts and music education in public schools. The majority of the musicians who we meet picked up an instrument for the first time at a school and had a teacher or somebody to kind of nourish that in them, and they're really eager to give back to that. So we listen and go to shows and try to find artists who put on a great show and put together the best festival that we can with a lot of different genres and a lot of different things for people to enjoy.
I'll repeat what you just said, which is that ticket sales benefit arts and music education in the Davis Public Schools.
That's correct, yes. Any proceeds from Davis Music Fest go to the Davis School Arts Foundation, which provides, over the last more than 30 years, funding and support for music and visual and performing arts programming in public schools.
So I'm going to tick off a list of veterans from Insight, and let's just compare a little and see if they've been on your stage as well. The Philharmonic.
Correct.
Jessica Malone.
Coming back.
Idea Team.
Yes.
Rebel, the Sean Thwaites Rebel Quartet.
Coming back again this year.
Poor Majesty.
Yep.
The Gold Souls.
Twice.
Lillian Francis.
Twice.
Dog Party.
Again, yes.
Okay, so you can hear all that music on Insight. Now let's talk about a few of the bands that haven't been in our studio, but your audiences love them and they're coming back. Where do you want to start?
Oh, yeah. So we've got all kinds of... first of all, one of the best things is we do try to balance our lineup with some favorites, local and traveling favorites that people around might already know a little bit about. With new acts as well. We like to think of it as an opportunity to discover, where you came for one band and stuck around for another and realize, yeah, hey, I really like this too.
Yeah.
And it's a great opportunity just to walk around and listen. Since it's on Saturday all over downtown, you're going to hear something coming from around the corner and you can go check it out. Let's see. Returning favorites. It really wouldn't be Music Fest without the West Nile Ramblers. They're the only band that's played every year for 9 years, and they have something really special planned for us on Friday this year. And
will you tell me about musician Jeremy Lyon?
Musician Jeremy, yeah. Oh, what a talented and busy person. He's in King Dream, and they're going to be playing Friday night as well. He also plays with band Whisker Man and with Rainbow Girls, and he's just super creative, really talented performer, puts on a great show, and it's one that you don't want to miss. You're going to have to come out a little bit earlier on Friday to catch him, but it's worth showing up for.
So he toured with, what, Tumbleweed Wanderers for
I think
a
originally,
number of
yes.
years? We're going to listen to a little of the music of King Dream, which is his new project, and that's who you can hear at the show.
Yeah, a little. We'll kick things off with a little bit of rock and roll.
Wish I could write songs about meadows and birds, but I'm a city kid, not talented in the smithing of words. I wish I could copyright the phrase I love you, serve a song on the radio, pay me a cent or two. Didn't get the business said on. We'll
time with the keyboard and mouse. Should we write a song, skip side of my south side? Did it work hard enough? The wars I waged on the team, drinking myself to sleep. Staying there till 1 p.m. thinking I got a problem. The days I'm losing track. But now I'm 4 years older and my heart's still cold and black.
That is Jeremy Lyon and King Dream. You can hear them at the Davis Music Fest this Saturday. What time?
Actually, they're playing Friday, 6:15 at the Sudwerk Brewing Company.
Okay, Friday night, 6:15. Up next, Mojo Green.
Mojo Green's coming back. Fan favorites, back literally by popular demand. Yeah. So many people saying, you must bring them back. We can't live without them. Really, really fun group coming out of the Reno, Tahoe area, bringing a big show.
Let's listen.
Now don't stop. Feel it, come and get it when the beat drop. Don't get down, get with it. We got the beat with the slap, so silly. Getting down with the knock, so that y'all feel me and feel me. Rattling your mandible, why? We're banging your rusty with the bone. Shake it, baby, feel the rhythm in your feet. Go ahead, ladies, and make the men get weak. Shake your thing. Shake your thing. Shake your thing. Shake your thing. To the beat,
that lip, his face like this marquee. I like bigger with the lips. Yeah, I'm sweet like nigga wish. Get bigger with the times and do what you like. I keep on doing it and doing it and doing it right. It ain't Friday night, but we gon' still get a drink to make us feel alright. Shake your thing.
All right, that's Mojo Green. Somebody is saying, when can I see them? And they are even more incredible live, I hear.
Live show is completely insane fun. We'll catch them at Delta of Venus on Saturday, kicking off at 9 o'clock p.m.
9 o'clock p.m. Okay. By the way, that horn forward funk, and this is partly female, or at least a female-fronted band, too.
Correct.
Is just such a good dance beat, kind of a fun party atmosphere.
I saw you moving a little bit.
I know. Our whole studio's kind of rocking with them right now. You're listening to Kyle Monholen. He is the executive director of the Davis Live Music Collective, and we're talking about the 9th Annual Davis Music Collective Festival. 40 bands, 6 venues across Davis, some indoors, some outdoors?
Correct. Yeah, we have some outdoor venues and some respite from the warmth indoors as well.
Okay. By the way, the news about Dimple Records, is that sort of echoing across your music collective friends and fans?
It's definitely part of the community, yeah. Personally, it's a sad thing for me. I love that place and definitely spent more than my fair share of money there, but apparently not enough. Yeah, it's a sad thing and it's a difficult thing and just a sign of the changing industry. One thing in the industry that really hasn't changed is the importance of live music and bands getting out and, you know, sharing what they do with fans and bringing people together in that way. We're really lucky in our community to have Armadillo Music, which has been going strong and keeps going strong and is actually a sponsor and supporter and a venue for Davis Music Fest.
I need to see a survey. It seems that the number of local bands is going up. The number of venues has been kind of waffling. Some have closed, others have opened, but what's happening in the band scene seems to be increasing. So let's talk about another one coming this weekend, Loud Forest.
Loud Forest. Yeah, we're really lucky to bring them up. They're a relatively new band with some, if you're really paying attention to Music Fest history, they're familiar faces, have played Music Fest under a different name in the past, but kind of regrouped into like a pop electronic dance rock outfit. And they're coming up from LA to play Music Fest, and really excited to have them. Hey!
talk when I can't stop thinking of you. You don't even know my name. Hey, I'm stuck in this loop. How do I live without love? What do I lose? I don't even play this game. I'm stuck in
again about them?
So Loud Forest, it's centered around a husband-wife duo from Pasadena, LA area, and they think they're traveling with four other musicians to fill out their sound.
And I like their voices together.
Singing, and really there's something really nice about the way they work together, both in unison and harmony, and it represents a lot of balance we tried to build in booking the fest in general.
How many bands do you listen to get to the 40?
Literally hundreds, counting alumni bands that we've had in the past and submissions that come to us kind of out of the blue, and then things that we go out seeking, like, oh, we heard about this great thing, we should check them out. It's close to 400 this year to book 40 bands.
So the day after the Music Fest finishes this year, you're beginning next year's work.
We've already started.
Oh. And a feeling you might say that. Okay, let's go to the Kafis Brothers and the Mountain Men.
A man with a dream, trying to be what I wanna be. But I'm nothing less than a liar and a cheat. If I'm not, then I'll make it be. But I got a plan, try to walk through the sand, gotta limp just across the line.
You ain't got the heart. Okay, the Kafis Brothers and the Mountain Men. Give me a few details about them, and when are they playing?
Sure. So they're literally brothers. The Kafis Brothers built around that band, and they're coming from Santa Cruz area.
Okay.
They've been playing with some great acts. I saw them last playing with the Mother Hips around New Year's, and they will be playing at the Oddfellows Hall at 10 p.m. on Saturday.
I think I miss saying when Loud Forest performs.
Loud Forest is playing at Sophia's Thai Kitchen stage, and their set starts at 9:30 on Saturday.
On Saturday. Okay. Yeah. All right. We have one more. 10-Foot Tiger. Tiger is a Sacramento band.
Sacramento Trio. Have they been on Insight yet?
They have not. However, I think the drummer has.
I think Billy's been everywhere.
Billy Thompson,
he's,
yeah.
He's going to be everywhere at Music Fest as well. I know he's at least on two stages. Yeah.
He's a great drummer, by the way.
Really great band. Really great rock, funk energy, and part of our Sunday lineup, which we kind of built as Thank you to locals. It's all Sacramento and Davis area bands and some real favorites, including Jessica Malone and the Big Poppies and the Return of the Dirt Feeling. So it's going to be basically just a big party on Sunday to wrap things up.
Okay, just for Jessica Malone fans, when does she perform and
Jessica
where?
Malone is going to be performing at 3:30 at Delta Venus on Sunday.
On Sunday, okay. Big festival. It keeps growing. Do you remember how many bands in the first year?
The first year, I think, was a dozen. It was just two stages toggling back and forth in one space. It was really just an excuse to have a big party, invite friends, and it grew from there. And thank goodness it's still going. Happy to keep it going.
Well, the event is entirely sponsored by local businesses and individuals, and then the money goes back to the schools. So it's really a grassroots celebration.
It is. And it's worth noting it's all volunteered. The musicians are all professionals and get paid, and our sound technicians do a great job and they get paid. But everybody else who has anything to do with festival, from doing the graphics, booking the acts, rentals, taking tickets and smiling, all volunteers.
All right, Kyle, you don't look as tired as I think you should at this point, but good luck.
We're just
for
getting
the weekend.
Started.
That's Kyle Mulholland. And again, the 9th Annual Davis Music Collective is this weekend. The festival is Friday, Saturday, Sunday. We'll post a link with all kinds of details and the website at capradio.org/insight. Good luck. Have a great weekend.
Thanks for having me. See everybody out there.
See you next year for the 10th.
I sure hope so.
That's Insight for today. I'm Beth Ruyak. We will have some special programs coming up for you over the next couple weeks. Hope you'll enjoy them, including some of our best of insights and favorites, too. In the meantime, Insight is produced by Cody Drabble and Kate Gonzalez. Our digital team is Chris Hagan, Casey Gardner, Emily Zentner. Our technical director is Mark Jones. Today's engineer is Anthony Van Hook. Our senior producer is Helen Barrington. Insight's executive producer is Joe Barr. Enjoy your weekend in any of the so many ways that are open to us in the region. Be safe, and thanks for joining us.